Okay, thank you for the opportunity to speak at Perimeter today. So what I'm going to be telling you about is an effect called color memory. And in particular, I'm going to tell you about how this arises in effective theory known as the color glass condensate. And this effective theory is used to describe high energy scattering at particle colliders. And what I will be saying today is based on two papers that I wrote with my collaborators, Anna Rakaryu, Andy Strominger, Adam Ball, and Raju Vinogopalan. Now, since my talk comes with such a long title, I would like to begin by commenting on some of the terms that appear in this title. So color memory refers to the fact that I will be discussing memory effects. And in this talk, I'll tell you what a memory effect is, but let me first just tell you why they're interesting. And the point is that memory effects are interesting because they are a universal feature of generic theories of gauge and gravity in the infrared. And the underlying reason why they're a universal feature is because that they're the observable consequence of symmetries that have been found to arise universally in the infrared. And this qualifier, color, refers to the fact that today our focus will be on memory effects that arise in classical Yang-Mills theory. Now, it turns out that one can argue based on physical grounds that classical Yang-Mills theory is an appropriate description for high energy scattering in the Regge limit. And the effective theory in which one finds such a description is known among the nuclear theory community as the color glass condensate. And so here, color refers to the fact that the degrees of freedom in this effective theory are deconfined, meaning that they carry color. Glass refers to a separation of time scales that is found in the Regge limit and is used to motivate this description. And condensate refers to the fact that in the Regge limit, the heavy ion wave function becomes heavily populated with gluon. So it emits a coherent state description, which is where we get this classical, which is where this classical description arises. And one of the key points that will be made in these two papers that I mentioned is that a key process that controls the observables that are constructed in this color glass condensate is the color memory effect. So in my talk, there are three points that I am going to try and make. And the first one is that the infrared sector of generic theories of gauge and gravity is governed by asymptotic symmetries whose observable consequence is the memory effect. And so this point is primarily background, but it's the crux of why you should care about being able to measure memory effects. And that is because, as this states, they are the observable consequence of symmetries in the infrared, which turn out to be these asymptotic symmetries. And moreover, this connection between asymptotic symmetries and memory effects is actually just part of a universal structure that underlies the infrared sector of generic theories of gauge and gravity. And so what this means is that we actually know what, for example, the gravitational analog is of this process that's occurring at high-energy particle colliders. And also, by actually being able to measure this memory effect, we are, if you will, obtaining experimental verification of asymptotic symmetries. So the second point here is that color memory is the net relative color rotation of a pair of nearby quarks induced by the passage of color rotation, of color radiation. And so what this second point is it's merely a statement of what color memory is. And today, in this talk, there are many ways to derive this statement, but I'm going to derive it from the conservation law that is implied by the presence of asymptotic symmetries in classical Yang-Mills theory. And The final statement is that the classical color memory effect arises in Regi limit scattering of heavy ions and can be measured at particle colliders. And so this last point addresses the fact, addresses how this classical color memory effect arises. And the key point, which I will explain, is that it's the kinematics and the Regi limit that make this possible. Okay, so as I said, to begin, I'm going to describe this universal structure that arises in the infrared sector of gauge theories. And this, again, is to motivate why you should care about being able to measure a memory effect. And so what this universal structure is it's a triad of equivalence between three well-known but previously unrelated subjects. But before describing this equivalence, I'd first like to review what these subjects are. And rather than explaining what they are in general, I'm going to focus on a particular example, and namely, that is the example that arises in gravitational theories in asymptotically flat spacetimes in four dimensions. Now, asymptotically flat spacetimes are precisely defined in general relativity, but if you are unfamiliar with that definition, you can think of them as a precise description of an isolated gravitational system, meaning that at long distances, the gravitational effects become weak and the system approximates Minkowski space. And so in the 1960s, Bondi, Metzner, Vandenberg, and Sachs set out to determine the symmetries of such spacetimes. And they were expecting to find Poincaré. But instead, what they found was an infinite dimensional enhancement of translations, and these are known as the supertranslations. Soon after, Weinberg was studying the behavior of scattering amplitudes that involved the emission of very low energy or soft gravitons. And what he found was that these scattering amplitudes could be simply related to the amplitudes without these soft emissions by a universal factor. And this is known as Weinberg's soft graviton theorem. And finally, Zeldovich and Polarev were studying the observable effects of gravitational radiation. So for example, if you consider the gravitational radiation that is emitted by the scattering of two massive objects, then as you go far from the scattering region, you find that this radiation approaches a sort of universal profile. And moreover, you find that there is a permanent shift in what turns out to be the transverse traceless component of the metric. And so in this sense, this component of the metric records or has a memory of the fact that gravitational radiation has passed. And moreover, this shift in the metric can actually be measured by inertial observers, and it's measured as a permanent shift in their relative displacement. So I've actually depicted this process here on the space-time diagram, where the blue lines represent the massive colliding objects. As they scatter, they emit gravitational radiation. And far away on this diagram is near these null boundaries, where I've placed inertial detectors whose world lines are represented in pink. And as you see, as they pass through the gravitational radiation, the world lines oscillate. And once they pass through the gravitational radiation, the world lines no longer oscillate, but they are displaced by a different amount generically than they were initially. And so this is the gravitational memory effect. Now, each of these three subjects were independently discovered and were also developed independently until several years ago in a series of papers, they were shown to be precisely equivalent. But the story doesn't end there, because this precise equivalence was actually merely an example of a more general phenomenon. So, namely, this precise equivalence could be generalized to other asymptotic symmetries in gravity, as well as to gauge theory. And the picture that emerged was a precise equivalence among memory effects, soft theorems, and asymptotic symmetries in generic theories of gauge and gravity. And so we summarized this equivalence with the so-called infrared triangle, where the three different subjects sit at the corner, and they are related, or their precise relations are represented by the edges. So for example, if we start with asymptotic symmetries, which are the symmetries that arise in theories with an asymptotic region or boundary, well, we can construct charges that generate these symmetries. And if you compute the Ward identity associated to these charges, you will find a soft theorem. Now, as I've mentioned, so the soft theorems, what they're telling you is they're telling you about the singularity structure of scattering amplitudes. In particular, when a massless external particle is taken to very low energy or taken to be soft. And what you find is you find a pole in frequency space. And by transforming this, Fourier transforming this pole in frequency space, you obtain a step function in time. And the step function in time is the shift in asymptotic data that is measured in the memory effect. And now, so as I mentioned, for this gravitational memory effect, the shift in asymptotic data is generated by the gravitational radiation that passes through null infinity. So what that means is that before and after the radiation passes, the system is in radiative vacuum. And what that means is that the shift in data is really a vacuum transition. And the connection to symmetries is that the conservation law that follows from this asymptotic symmetry predicts the shift in vacuum given a profile of the transit of radiation. And these different vacua are actually related by the action of this asymptotic symmetry. And we've actually been able to learn quite a bit from this precise equivalence, primarily because different physical significance has been attributed to each of these different corners. So for example, as theorists, we love symmetries, right? Because we know, once we know of a symmetry, we have a whole set of questions to ask, such as, is it anomalous? Is it spontaneously broken? And we also have a whole set of tools for dealing with symmetries, such as we know that there are conservation laws following from Noether's theorem, or the Hilbert space is going to be organized into irreducible representations. However, for anybody who's familiar with this asymptotic symmetry analysis, it's a little imprecise. And so knowing that there are these other two corners helps deal with it. So normally it's imprecise, and one actually needs to check that these symmetries are physical at the end of the day. But knowing that they are actually precisely related to soft theorems and memory effects serves as this check that they actually have physical meaning. Likewise, soft theorems, so as I said, this is a statement about singularity structures of scattering amplitudes. And in the quantum field theory literature, the statement turns into a statement about how soft radiation is highly constrained in terms of the hard scattering particles that are participating in the scattering process. But now, knowing that the soft theorem is related to the asymptotic symmetry, we understand that this constraint is actually nothing more than the conservation law that followed from the asymptotic symmetry. And finally, memory effects serve as the observable consequence. And so they really put these asymptotic symmetries on sort of firm, you know, pedestrian ground. And also the fact that they're related to a symmetry actually may make them a little bit more robust to being measured in an experiment. Okay, so that concludes what I was going to say about the universal structure of the infrared sector gauge and gravity theories. And for the rest of the talk, we're going to focus on classical Yang-Mills theory. And in particular, we're going to be interested in the memory effect associated to those theories. So to get at this memory effect, the first thing I'm going to do is derive the asymptotic symmetries of classical Yang-Mills theory. And I'm going to do this via the standard asymptotic symmetry analysis, in which the physical symmetries are identified as the allowed gauge symmetries quotiented by trivial gauge symmetries. So what allowed gauge symmetries are is that to construct a phase space, one imposes boundary conditions on the fields. And allowed gauge symmetries are the symmetries that preserve these boundary conditions. And these are, and so the physical ones are distinguished from the trivial ones in the sense that the trivial ones act trivially on your phase space. Now, since we're going to be interested in the boundary conditions on fields, we will be interested in the boundary of the space-time of our theory. And since we're considering just pure gauge theory, our space-time is Minkowski space. And a useful tool for studying the boundary is the Penrose diagram, which I've depicted here. And as we see, the boundaries are these null hypersurfaces. And in particular, we are going to be interested in radiative phase space constructed at past and future null infinity. And for studying this, it is useful to introduce the so-called retarded radial coordinate system, where we introduce a retarded time u, and we keep our radial coordinate r from the Cartesian coordinates. And finally, we use stereographic coordinates on the celestial sphere z and z bar. And the reason why these coordinates are useful is because we can reach future null infinity by taking r to infinity at fixed u, z, and z bar. Then u is the affine parameter along null generators at future null infinity. And z and z bar are stereographic coordinates on the sphere, which is the spatial slice of null infinity. OK. And so in order to perform this asymptotic symmetry analysis, we need to introduce boundary conditions. But we don't just want to choose any boundary conditions. We want to choose ones that are physically reasonable. And so we can do this by requiring that the boundary conditions we choose yield finite and non-vanishing charge and energy energy configurations. So in this coordinate system, for example, one can identify the energy density as being quadratic in the radiative electric fields and falling off like 1 over r squared. And since you know, the area of the sphere grows like r squared, in order to have a finite energy configuration, we want these uz components of the field strength to be of order 1. Likewise, in order to have finite charge configurations, we study the Coulombic electric field, which goes into the electric charge, and we determine that this ur component should be of order 1 over r squared. And by similar arguments, you can argue that the Rz component, the field strength, should also fall off like 1 over r squared. So, so to summarize, what we've done is we've found physically motivated boundary conditions on our field strengths, but we are going to be interested in the fall-off conditions on field, gauge fields themselves. And so these field strengths suggest that the boundary conditions for the gauge field should be such that z component is order 1, the r component is order 1 over r squared, and the u component is order 1 over r. And so once we've obtained these boundary conditions for our gauge field, we can now identify the allowed symmetries as those symmetries which preserve these boundary conditions. And so in particular, symmetries that preserve these boundary conditions are u independent to leading order in 1 over r. Now, of course, to obtain the physical symmetries, we need to quotient by trivial symmetries. And to do that, we can perform a canonical analysis in which we construct charges and see how they act on the radiative phase space. And the point is that the physical symmetries will have non-trivial action on radiative phase space. So in order to do this, it is useful to introduce an asymptotic expansion where now my notation is that script fields refer to full bulk fields and depend on all four coordinates, u, r, z, and z bar, whereas the non-script fields just depend on u, z, and z bar, and where the R dependence is explicitly shown. And the non-script fields are the leading order components in an asymptotic expansion about null infinity. And so by doing this, we can identify variables on radiative phase space at future null infinity, and these include the transverse component of the gauge field, and importantly, as was shown in some previous analysis, it includes their zero mode. And by that, I mean zero frequency mode. And one finds that you can construct charges that generate the symmetry, and these charges depend on only this leading order piece of the gauge parameter near null infinity. And so what we find is that quotienting by trivial transformations in this picture simply amounts to identifying symmetry transformations that differ at subleading order in 1 over R. So these charges that I just introduced, under they generate what looks like a usual gauge transformation on the radiative fields at on the radiative fields, which are our variables of radiative phase space. And the important point is actually this first term. And it is, you can think of it as an inhomogeneous transformation of the field. And the reason why it's important is that if we consider the action of the symmetry on a classical vacuum gauge configuration, meaning a configuration that is pure gauge, we find that it transforms non-trivially under the symmetry. And what that tells us is that the charges are acting non-trivially on vacuum configurations, meaning that the vacuum is charged under the symmetry, which means that the symmetry is spontaneously broken. And so what we find is that the space of inequivalent vacua is actually the space of flat connections on the sphere. And so the claim is that by using the conservation law, which I'm about to get to, that follows from these symmetries, one finds that color flux through null infinity induces such vacuum transitions. And moreover, the vacuum transitions are physical because they produce an observable shift in relative colors of pairs of test quarks that are located at different points on the celestial sphere.
Sorry, yes. The very easy is that as part of your assumption condition, or is it an additional restriction?
No, it's an additional restriction. So we're considering. It's not the most general thing. It's you're asking the question, suppose my system is in radiative vacuum. And by radiative vacuum, I just mean that A is flat.
Can I ask something?
Yes.
If I remember correctly, some people were saying that one would have to be careful that these quarks could be dressed by some radiative cloud of gluons, so that when you act on the quarks, you don't act just on the quarks, but also on the gluons, and that the two effects would eventually cancel out, leading to no physical observable effect. What I have in mind was something that Amit Sever and his collaborator did for QED, where for QED, they were saying the electron, there they could, it was a billion, so they could compute better, and they were saying that the electron had to be dressed by all this cloud of photons, and that one should be careful that the symmetry should also act on these fully dressed states.
Yeah, so this,
something reasonable.
Yes, yeah, so this story was beautifully addressed, actually, in a paper by Anil Rakaryu and Dan Kopetz and Andy Strominger and Malcolm Perry, and what they showed was that there's a conservation law, or you can think of it as the Gauss constraint. And so there are actually, this middle equation here. And so matter, charged matter, produces non-zero JU. And there are different ways in which you can solve this constraint. You can either solve it in terms of the Coulombic degrees of freedom, which is this the RU component, or you can solve it in terms of the radiative degrees of freedom. And what they found was that, so if you try and solve it entirely in terms of the Coulombic degrees of freedom, then you generically actually cannot satisfy this conservation law entirely, because there's a non-trivial matching condition that must be imposed at spatial null infinity. And so what they found is that actually, in order to satisfy this conservation law, you need to turn on some of these radiative modes. And these radiative modes are nothing more than actually the Fadyev-Kulish dressings that were introduced by Fadyev-Kulish to render the S matrix finite. And these, right, so that's the first part of the story. And in, if you do this, if you, right, so then there are several ways you can do this. And the point is that what you can do is you can have incoming particles, and you can dress them with their radiative photon, with their radiative clouds.
So
they will be Fadyev-Kulish states, and you, if you ask what their charge is zero. So as you said, they don't transform. And likewise, you can consider outgoing charged particles, and you can dress them with their radiative clouds, and they also are charged zero. But you don't have to do it in this way. What you can do is you can move the radiative clouds associated to the in-state to the out-state. So classically, what you can think of this as is you can think of this as solving the problem of I have charged particles scattering, and I solve it with a retarded propagator. So all the radiation comes out afterwards. And this was shown, so this was conjectured in the paper that I just mentioned, and then it was proven in a paper, subsequent papers by Akuri and collaborators. And so in those cases, if you move the clouds, then you find actually that the charge is non-zero, and these states actually do carry this charge. And so, in other words, this charge acts non-trivially on these states.
Well, physically, this cloud was just that the particle is moving and radiating some cloud particles with it. I thought it was something a little bit like a jet, not that it was something a little bit physical.
Well, so
it would be natural to consider those clouds because it's with those states that when you scatter, you get infrared finite.
But you don't. But what was shown is that you don't have to. Those are just merely an example of states that you can scatter and get infrared finite scattering matrices. The critical point is that you need to satisfy this conservation law, and this conservation law can be satisfied whether you put the radiation in the incoming state or move it to the outgoing state. And if you move it to the outgoing state, then these particles actually carry the large gauge charge.
And should I think of the two scenarios as two different experiments?
You should think of them as two different experiments, but I think so again, this isn't my result, but I think the feeling of those authors was that it is more physical to consider the case when all the radiation is in the outgoing state, simply because at a particle collider, I don't send in radiation to make sure that this conservation law is satisfied along with my charged particles. But instead, all the radiation should come out afterwards. And classically, again, you can think of this just as I've solved a problem in electromagnetism with a retarded propagator, so everything comes out afterwards.
Thank you.
Yes.
I might have a silly question. So this is mostly infrared classical argument. I can see how to make sense of it in QED, but the QCD in the infrared would be confining, right?
Yes.
So are you going to comment on it? Some?
We're going to get there, yes.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yes.
So you're saying that when you prepare, and this is a question, that you don't necessarily prepare states that are dressed, that you could just prepare states as you thought that you would naively.
Yes.
When you're scattering them, they come out, they have this additional soft radiation, which is where the dressing went.
Yes. I should say, they will carry a coulombic part. So for example, if you're scattering something with charge, you know, it does carry something. There's not, yeah. Did,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. Right. Okay, so now I'm going to, right, so what we wanted to do was we wanted to see actually that this vacuum transition is induced by color flux through null infinity, and actually this can be predicted by the conservation law that follows from these symmetries. So in order to construct the conservation law, the first thing to do is to recognize that there is an analogous analysis that one can perform for a radiative phase space constructed at past null infinity, and one finds analogous charges. And I should mention, so this charge here is constructed at the past boundary of future null infinity, and the charge that generates the symmetry on past null infinity is constructed at their future boundary. And so a matching condition on these fields, it turns out an antipodal matching condition on these fields across a spatial infinity implies a conservation law for these charges. And since this conservation law is true for arbitrary epsilon, which was local on the sphere, this means that this is actually a local conservation law on the celestial sphere. And a particularly useful form of this conservation law can be obtained by using this Gauss constraint and re-expressing the charges as integrals. So for example, this future charge as an integral over future null infinity. And the reason why it's useful is because now one can see the contributions from the different terms. So in particular, the current contributes a color flux term, whereas this term that includes the radiative components of the gauge fields, well, one notices that actually, given our boundary conditions, it's a total derivative with respect to u. So if one actually performs this u integral, one sees that that term is actually including a change in the transverse component of the gauge field. And what that will be is it will be for us, it will tell us about our vacuum transition. Okay, so to discuss the color memory effect, now we are going to focus on particular scenarios, as you notice, that have this property that they begin and end in radiative vacuum. And so what I mean by that is that the field strength, the UZ component and the ZZ bar component of the field strength are zero, which means, just as we found before, these configurations are flat connections on the sphere. But since we're interested in a vacuum transition, we want to consider a scenario when there's color flux at intermediate times. And so for convenience, we'll work in a temporal gauge. And what we can do is we can rearrange this conservation law. And what we find is we find the vacuum transition, so the change in the flat connection, as a function of the color flux that is passing through future null infinity. And the fact that although it's pure, although the at late times, the gauge configuration is pure gauge, it actually has a memory of the fact that color flux is passed through because it cannot be equal to whatever gauge configuration it was at the initial, at initial times. And just to put it on very solid ground, the claim is that this vacuum transition induces a permanent rotation in the relative colors of test quarks. And this should be thought of as the direct analogy of the gravitational memory effect, in which the transit of gravitational radiation induced a permanent shift in the relative displacement of inertial observers. Okay, so to understand this claim, What we're going to do is we're going to consider a case in which we have a pair of test quarks that begin in a color singlet at initial time ui. And what that means is that if I parallel transport them to a common point on the sphere, their colors align classically. Now, what we do is we take them and we fix them at distinct points on the sphere. We allow them to evolve forward in retarded time as the color flux passes through. And then at the final time, we parallel transport 2 to 1 to compare their colors. So the general evolution for the quark colors is just this parallel transport equation. And so if we, for simplicity, consider the case where the flat connection is actually precisely 0 at the initial time, then generically, due to the color flux, it cannot be 0 at the final time. And during this process, as we separate the quarks at the initial time, they quarks a color, no color rotation. Since we're working in temporal gauge, as they evolve forward in U, they also acquire no color rotation. But at the final time, since this connection is while flat, is no longer 0, if we parallel transport them to compare their colors, we find that they've acquired a relative color rotation, which is determined in terms of this final non-vanishing flat connection. And so since the initial connection was precisely vanishing, the final non-vanishing flat connection really is just the difference between the flat connections at initial and final times. And so this relative color rotation is measuring the vacuum transition. And as an object, this relative color rotation is gauge covariant and transforms psi conjugation. But we can take a trace and obtain a gauge invariant object, which is simply given by the trace of the path order exponential of the gauge field along the contour that is traced out by the world lines of the quarks. And so this is the color memory effect. Okay.
So this is just the analog of Aronson bomb for nanabelian, right?
It's a little
hard because they go up on the loop and they acquire this phase.
It's a little different. So the difference is in Aronson foam, you technically never want the quarks to, or the, you know, particles or whatever, to encounter regions of non-zero field strength. And here they're actually allowed to. So at this intermediate time, nothing told me that I couldn't have passed my quarks through a region of non-zero field strength. But yes.
So when you say flat connections, are you looking at flat SUN bundles of S2?
Yes. Or whatever gauge theory you want.
Well, the reason I ask is it SUN or add SUN, a joint action of SUN that you are interested in? Because you want to transform under the adjoint group.
Oh, no. So we want our quarks to transform in the fundamental representation. So like,
quarks transform.
Yeah.
So when you look at the change, is it the change that is induced by the action of the center of SUN that you will see?
No, it's the change.
The change will be some generic element of SUN.
Just some, yes.
So just so I understand,
yes.
It's the usual effect, but you call it memory because the particles can go on a loop, they interact in some flux at some point, and then nothing happens for a long time, and at the end you measure, and you say, because it happened a long time ago, I call it memory. Is it why we call it? Because for me, that's just a loop.
Yeah,
this phase looks like the usual phase acquired whenever you go.
It is.
It's not a loop of particles, it's a loop in the vacuum.
Oh, but you can think of that as a quark, two quarks that go away and they meet again, right?
Yeah. And it's memory because it's a scenario where it begins and ends in radiative vacuum. But it's how you, the question is, so some people call memory effect just this shift in the gauge field. Some shift in asymptotic component of the gauge field, and you read papers and that's they derive this shift and they say that's the memory effect.
Okay,
we like to say, you know, actually there's some little experiment you can do, which is an RNA foam type experiment that actually measures this shift because, well, you can be worried that something that's a shift in a gauge field is not something that's visible. In a gauge field, right, not field strength. So, yeah.
Is it also that here you have radiation, so it passes into these blur lines as opposed to the iron bone for group just as like a solid in the field?
That's what I was saying. Yeah, so in particular, so the memory effects, which are actually related to soft theorems and asymptotic symmetries, importantly encode radiation because the radiation is the thing that will have a 1 over omega frequency pull. So there is that, yes. Okay, so now we arrive at this last part where I'm going to address how this classical color memory effect actually arises in something that is experimentally accessible. And so just as a disclaimer, we're going to be working in an effective theory that is used in nuclear theory, and I am learning this, and I don't claim to be an expert, but I will answer your questions as best I can. And also, the way this effective theory is arrived at is by physical arguments, we'll see. Okay, so what we're going to be interested in is we're going to be interested in scattering in the Regge limit. And so what the Regge limit is, it's a limit of fixed momentum transfer with center mass energy taken to infinity. And so in Mendelssohn variables, this is T fixed with S to infinity. And one of the processes we're going to be interested in is deeply inelastic scattering. And so as you recall, this is where we probe some heavy particles, such as a heavy ion, with an electron. And the electron probes it by exchanging a virtual photon. And so one can construct a Lorentz invariant object known as Bjorken X. And it's defined to be the ratio of the momentum of the exchange photon squared divided by 2 times the momentum of the hadron times the momentum of the exchange photon. And one finds that this scales like T over S. So in the Regge limit, this Bjorken X goes to 0. And also, one can show that in this 2-2 scattering process, Bjorken X is actually fixed by kinematics to coincide with the longitudinal momentum fraction that is carried by the struck particle. So in a deeply inelastic scattering, the electron probes a heavy ion by exchanging a virtual photon. That virtual photon hits some particle that's in the heavy ion, and it carries some fraction of the hadron momentum, and that fraction is X. So the point of this slide is that in the Regge limit, we probe partons, or primarily gluons, that are carrying just a small fraction of the hadron momentum. So in these infective field theories, they like to use light cone coordinates, where here we're going to be working in light cone coordinates, which pick out the x3 direction. And in order to resolve the dynamics at small x, which are these ones that are probed in the Regge limit, we will work in the so-called infinite momentum frame. And for a hadron moving in the x plus direction, this is the frame obtained by infinitely boosting this hadron such that its plus component of its momentum goes to infinity. And so in the infinite momentum frame, all the degrees of freedom, since we've done an infinite boost, are traveling in the x plus direction, so we can regard x plus as time. Now, to see why the infinite momentum frame is useful for resolving this dynamics at small x, we notice that the typical lifetime of a particle that is carrying light cone momentum k plus, which is fraction x times t plus. So its lifetime, as I said, we're going to think of x plus as time. And so using the uncertainty principle, its lifetime scales like 1 over k minus, And then using the on-shell condition, we find that is equal to 2 over k plus times divided by mass perpendicular, which includes both the perpendicular contributions of the momentum as well as the mass of the particle. And the point is that this scales like x. So what it means is that particles that are carrying larger fractions of the momentum are long-lived in comparison to particles that are partons that are carrying a small fraction of the momentum. And so the idea is then that you use a Born-Oppenheimer type approximation and treat the large x degrees of freedom, which carry a large fraction of the momentum, as static sources for the gluons at small x. Now, one performs a similar analysis for a longitudinal spread. And in this case, we find that the spread of different partons actually scales like 1 over x. So that means that the partons that are carrying a large fraction of the momentum are actually highly localized in this null x minus direction. And so for the purposes of studying small x dynamics, we're going to work in this a plus equals 0 gauge. We can approximate the large x degrees of freedom as a color shock wave that travels in the x plus direction and is delta function localized in this x minus direction. And so the point is that, OK, this, in some hand-wavy way, resembles a local color flux through null infinity that induces vacuum transitions, simply because it's localized along a null direction so that there will be a time before and after when the system is in radiative vacuum. Now, it turns out, so in these theories, they are interested in additional configurations that obey additional constraints, namely that the minus component of the gauge field is zero, there are no longitudinal magnetic fields, which are these IJ components, and also that the configurations are static, meaning that they don't depend on this x plus coordinate, which we are interpreting as time. And so if one additionally imposes these constraints, then one finds that there's only one non-trivial component of the Yang-Mills equation. And if we take an integral of it over a null direction, we obtain some equation that resembles the formula we had previously for vacuum transition. Namely, we have a change in the gauge field that is given by a flux through a null surface, a flux of color through a null surface. But in order to make this precise, we really want to be able to interpret this null surface as actually being null infinity. And so we did this, and the way to understand this is that the first thing we need to do is we need to identify the analog of the infinite momentum frame for the null, for the observer at null infinity. And in order to do this, the thing to notice is that Lyapunov coordinates are nice coordinates actually for the infinite momentum frame because they transform simply under boosts in the x3 direction, meaning that they transform by these simple rescalings. And so the infinite momentum frame is simply reached by taking this lambda to infinity. And the reason why they're nice coordinates is not just because they transform simply under rescaling, but really it's because since they transform simply under rescaling, you can readily obtain infinite momentum frame configurations from configurations in other inertial frames. And just a simple example to illustrate this point, consider for example, charge current sourced by a particle of constant orbit velocity. So I've written this in light cone coordinates in some arbitrary frame. And under a boost, one obtains the boosted current configuration by just evaluating it at the boosted four momentum. But since these four momentum now transform simply just by rescaling, it's very easy to see that in the infinite moment, as we take lambda to infinity, only the plus component remains and is in fact proportional to a delta function in x minus. So in other words, this is another way of getting at this color shockwave, which we motivated physically previously. Now, on the other hand, these retarded radial coordinates that we were using do not transform nicely, meaning by rescaling under boost in the x3 direction. However, we liked them because we understood what it meant to go to null infinity in these coordinates. I take r to infinity at fixing the rest of the coordinates. And so one can work really hard and try and find a coordinates that satisfy both, but there's a nice trick to obtain these coordinates, and that is to perform a singular coordinate transformation by this rescaling where now I take lambda to infinity. And the point is that in these new coordinates, further rescalings of this form are actually now identified as boosts in the x3 direction. And what one finds is the sphere is instead flattened to a transverse plane, and that's essentially because what this transformation is doing is it's zooming in on the point on the celestial sphere that is associated to the x3 direction. And so one finds that these new rescaled coordinates are related to light cone coordinates by these formulas. And the important thing is the first one, which allows us to identify the r goes to infinity limit with the x plus goes to infinity limit. And so all that remains is to take this x plus to infinity limit of this vacuum transition formula. But we found that this vacuum transition formula was actually x plus independent anyway. And so the point is that actually it can be placed at null infinity for free. So the upshot is that these small x gluon configurations, which are sourced by the current generated by the large x gluons, which are carrying a larger fraction of the momentum of the hadron, actually are the vacuum-to-vacuum field configurations, which are governed by the conservation law for large gauge symmetry. And so now the final question is, can we measure these? And in other words, what are the analogs of the test quarks that would actually arise in particle collisions? And so what we found was that in this effective description, we found these vacuum-to-vacuum field configurations, which we identified as the vacuum-to-vacuum field configurations that are predicted by the conservation law for large gauge symmetry. And so what we want to do is we want to find observables that are sensitive to these vacuum-to-vacuum configurations. And so the idea is to, since this effective theory is used to predict a wide range of observables, it turns out that actually a wide range of observables are sensitive to these vacuum-to-vacuum field configurations. But what we'll study is we'll study a more simple scattering in which the way that the observable depends on the vacuum transition is more simple. And so the simple scattering process is electron heavy ion deep inelastic scattering. So as I mentioned previously, what happens in this process is that the electron probes the heavy ion by exchanging a virtual photon. And in the Regel limit, the dominant effect is that it splits into a quark-antiquark pair, which traverses this heavy ion and acquires a net color. And so in the Iconal approximation, what we find is that this shock wave induces a color rotation on each quark, and this forward scattering amplitude for this process is actually just this object we found previously, which was this trace of the quark-dipole color rotation. So this pair of quarks is sometimes referred to as a quark dipole. Now, this object here is, of course, so recall this color rotation is a function of the vacuum transition, which we also saw from the conservation law was determined in terms of some color source through a null surface. But one actually doesn't know exactly the precise configurations of the partons within a hadron. And so in the color glass condensate, the prescription is that one, to obtain an observable one, must average over these color sources with some weighting function. And so physically what happens is that, for example, if the size of the dipole is larger, then relative color rotation between them will be larger, and upon averaging over these different color sources, they average to zero. Whereas if the dipole is very small, then the color rotation they acquire is rather small and approximately the identity. And so what one finds is that there's an emergent scale, which is the size of the dipole where this transition occurs. And so actually, to put this into an observable, one can relate this forward scattering amplitude, or one can obtain the dipole cross-section via the optical theorem from this forward scattering amplitude. And this dipole cross-section goes into building many different observables, but one of them is this inclusive deep inelastic virtual photon heavy ion cross-section, which is obtained by convoluting the dipole cross-section against the probability for the virtual photon to split into a quark-antiquark pair of size r and carrying a certain momentum fraction.
So, you have mentioned this, but that average of curly S, that's the partial distribution function? What is that average?
It's an average over the distribution of color sources. So,
okay, so
one splits, one does some split where some of the partons one views as being, quote, small x, and those are the ones that are sourced by the ones at larger x. And the ones at larger x, you average over what configurations those contain.
This is just a parton distribution function. One usually talks about it.
It's a little different in the sense that in this effective theory, what they do is they compute, they begin with some ansatz for what this distribution should be, and then they have evolution equations, which are not, these are like, they're generalizations of some of the evolution equations. So this one comes with the name JIM. And they use that ansatz. So they use that ansatz and then evolve it with the evolution equation. And then there's in some approximation, or sorry, I think once they evolve it, they find that there is some sense in which once they evolve it, it didn't matter what ansatz they began with. So that's how this works.
But does that stuff give you an insight on this Banksy gene equation?
I don't know. Actually, Michael.
It's still some kind of distribution evolution for the rapidities of coming from the dipole-dipole interaction. So it feels like there should be some story to it.
Actually, that's what one of my collaborators is very interested in. But that's to be discovered. Yeah, not sure. Right, okay. So my summary is simply the three points that I was trying to make during this talk. And as for future directions, so in order to make this connection to experiment, we had to study how this symmetry would arise, or understand how this symmetry would arise in the Regi limit. And so one thing that I think would be interesting would be to study the interplay of constraints on QCD amplitudes from the asymptotic symmetries that arise both in the infrared and the Regi limits, and in particular where they overlap. And then also this just opens the door for a more general study of what the implications of asymptotic symmetries are for just Reggie limit physics. All right, that's it. Yes?
I'm sorry, I don't think I understand the answer to my question. So it looks like that you have a model, right, so this color loss compensate. And so the effects of basically color memory on a small x, complex phenomena in physics and color loss compensate. Now, color loss compensate, I would say, is reliably described by kinetic theory. You have large occupation now, but once you go to small x, I'm not sure how well is it described by kinetic theory. So it's just another way of asking the question, why should I believe that, the classical Young-Mills is a valid description in the infrared?
Well, I think one answer to your question would be, if they build this future electron ion collider and test these theories more rigorously, right? I mean, people don't know. This is what, that's one thing that.
Maybe I can rephrase my question.
Yeah.
Is there any observable of this on bound states or something that, gauge invariant objects?
So I don't.
Is there any observable of color memory effect on, say, hadrons?
I mean, so as it states right, yeah, as it stands right now, we understand how color memory arises in the color glass condensate. And what I understand is you would like something more than that, right? And to that, I don't have a good answer.
Maybe another way to rephrase the question would be, where do you see the role of confinement in this way of trying to understand?
So within this theory, these processes are all happening at distances much shorter than confinement. So this is why you're in the deconfined phase. But the point is that there is still a sense in which one can have a vacuum transition in the deconfined phase. Now, of course, this is happening at very small distances, but this theory, or the color glass condensate, predicts that there is a sense of a vacuum transition just even at these very short distances.
So the comparison between having this shockwave type bridging at finite distance and the similarity with vacuum transitions out of infinity, it's a good reminiscent of, like, in gravity, the expectation that whatever happens very close to the horizon is maybe characteristically similar to what happens all the way out of infinity, just because you have two null surfaces and then intermorphisms on the surface in a certain way. So is it just possible that instead of trying to pull one effect all the way out to infinity, see that all the same similar thing, that you could just, by first principles, go back to the light cone gauge, go to the infinite momentum frame, and then just try to redo the analysis of, well, what gauge transformations what are the true gauge transformations for states that survive this kind of infinite boost? Modular the ones that are somehow trivial, as in you just try to think of redoing this analysis that got you the asymptotic symmetries in the first place, but now in this at this finite level, but with the infinite boost. It just looks like this. They look like a system.
Sure. Yeah. Probably. Yes.
Any more questions? So Monica will be around for today, and we're also going to have a speaker's dinner at 6 p.m. And be really interested, especially talking more to Monica. Thank the speaker.